Dexter is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Stay with us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of Willie Pondexter in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Nancy Bailey, and special guest Gabriel Salas, associate director of the Texas After Violence Project. The Execution Watch begins. Don't you know they're killing people? 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 Don't you know they're killing people?
And I am Ray Hill. You're listening to radio station KPFT HD 2 channel, and you're listening to live internet broadcast on executionwatch.com, kpft.org, excuse me, executionwatch.org, kpft.org, and of course the prisonshow.org. I am in studio here on this Tuesday night because of Willie Earl Pondexter, and other news media mispronouncing his name, calling him Poindexter, but there's no I in Pondexter, and it's pronounced Pondexter. Mr. Pondexter is awaiting. Last conversation I had with Gloria Rubeck in Huntsville, they were waiting word from the United States Supreme Court. Mr. Pondexter's attorneys have put in a last-minute appeal to delay the execution on the premise that his lawyer's assistants, Harvard law students, were actually picked up by an East Texas sheriff and locked away, reminiscent of the freedom riders of the 1960s having trouble with local sheriffs. And the problem is that the lawyers say they were unable to complete their application for clemency because those legal assistants were not able to continue the work. We now have Gloria Rubeck from Huntsville. Gloria, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm standing outside of the death chamber. The media witnesses have just gone in. Some chaplains who were witnessing on behalf of Willie have gone in. And we're going to have the ninth execution in, what, 8 or 9 weeks in Texas. So the gutless Supreme Court, I guess, followed suit from the Fifth Circuit, which denied his appeal about this, which was a civil rights appeal.
Have you gotten final word from the Supreme Court?
Yeah, the Supreme Court turned it down.
The Supreme Court turned it down. Well, let me explain to the audience that the person on guard for Texas at the Supreme Court of the United States is Justice Scalia, if he's available. And that execution votes from Justice Scalia are inherently predictable. Now, if something happens and he's out of pocket, they use a substitute judge who I believe is Justice Kennedy. Who may have a different point of view, but if it's Scalia voting, we have executions. If it's Kennedy voting, well, there's a chance that we might not.
Well, according to Dennis Longmire, who's here with me, Dennis said that the case definitely had merit, and it was for the Fifth Circuit to dismiss it without giving an opinion should have upset the Supreme Court, but I guess it didn't.
Well, it depends on, you only have to deal with one person on the initial call.
I see.
And then that judge makes a decision whether you want to bind it over for the other judges to continue or not. But I'll be discussing that. But right now, the witnesses from the media have been ushered in. Are any witnesses from the family?
No family members, just a couple of chaplains apparently went in to be with Willie. Those were his witnesses.
Okay, Gloria, we're going to continue with Execution Watch at this point. If anything breaks, let us know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that was Gloria Rubeck. She is with... There you go. Gloria is an activist with Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, and she is the reporter in Huntsville tonight. We've got another vigil going on and we'll be in touch with them later in the program. And tonight, Nancy Bailey is representing the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty as well, and she's with the Houston group. I have with me Jim Skelton. Jim, we're again talking about somebody's execution. What can you tell us about this case?
This is, I hate to say, not a typical death penalty case. This probably today would not be a death penalty case. What occurred, this happened up in the North Texas area and up around the Dallas area, and there was a very wealthy lady named Martha Lennox. And apparently, she wasn't reclusive, but she apparently was a very low-keyed woman, lived by herself, lived in a kind of a fancy old Victorian house up in what they call Red River County. And five young men decided that they needed money, were going to rob her house. And it was one of those things, and you kind of get the impression when they get together and decide to do the robbery or burglary of the house, they were kind of hyping each other up a whole lot. You kind of get that impression. And so what happened, they went to a club, drank some beer, did all the things they normally do to build up their manhood. And then what happened, five of them approached the house, and a patrol car go by, and they got scared and backed off, and they went up to the house. And finally, when they decided to go back up the second time, one of the guys named James Bell took off running. It just left only four. He decided to vacate, and he left. So four guys broke into the house. One of them kicked the door in. I think Pondexter was the one that got acquitted for kicking the door in. So what happened, when they kicked the door in, they go running upstairs, and there is an 85-year-old woman named Martha Lennox on the bed. And they're demanding money and going to rob her at this point. And there's one gun among them, and a guy by the name of James Henderson has a gun. And at this point, a guy by the name of Dion Williams steals a woman's purse. I think they get a total of $7 out of her purse, her coin purse. And when they get the money out of the coin purse, James Henderson shoots Miss Lennox in the head, shoots her apparently in the forehead. Then he grabs it, then he hands the gun over to Pondexter and tells Pondexter to also do a shooting. In fact, they had talked earlier, part of what they were, at least the testimony indicated, that they were wondering if any of them had the heart to do what was necessary. Other words, have the heart to carry through a killing and have the heart to carry through what they're supposed to carry through. So Pondexter shot her in the head also. She died of two gunshot wounds to the head. And then after they, at that point, they stole her car and left. And about 2 weeks later, they arrest Pondexter inside the car, her stolen car. And then what happened during the trial, one of the guys, Dion Williams, who was present during the robbery murder, testified against both Henderson and against Pondexter. Henderson was tried first, got the death penalty. Thereafter, Pondexter was tried, and he was given the death penalty.
Only two death penalty cases out of the four people involved.
Four people involved. One of them testified for the state, so he obviously got some sort of sweetheart deal. Mm-hmm. But the actual two guys who pulled the trigger, who actually were the trigger men in this gun, in this case, both of them received the death penalty.
Well, anything remarkable in the appeals?
The appeal was kind of unique in this part. One of the things, and the courts are real good about doing this, they're always establishing tests that nobody can ever pass. I mean, they've loved to make up, oh, we got these wonderful remedies, but no one ever passes the remedies. And one of the things that happened, they changed, this is kind of unusual in a capital murder case, any case, they changed venue from Red River County to Bowie County. And that's a rare thing that's done, because it's very, very difficult to get a change of venue. As a matter of fact, the only case in recent history that's been reversed for not granting a change of venue was the Jack Ruby case. It's how long ago it's been. So a change of venue is kind of unusual. Anyway, they try it in Bowie County. Well, the first issue they raised on appeal is that something like 22% of the residents of Bowie County are members of minorities. And when they call the jury panel to hear his case, fewer than 10% of the jury panel had to be minority members. So what happened, you have like a 20% population, 22% population minorities, that includes African Americans, Hispanics, and every minority. And your jury panel shows up, and only about 10% of them happen to be members of that minority. They file a motion across the jury panel. And here, and that's, and this happens fairly often. It happened in some of the earlier death penalty cases, and it's really difficult on appeal to say that that's unfair. And here's what the courts basically tell you. And there's a three-part test that they have you to pass. And the first part is you got to be able to say the part that's underrepresented on the jury panel is a recognized minority group, which in this case it was.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing you've got to be able to demonstrate is that your panel has an under-majority representation. And in this case, 22% minority, 10% in the panel, they showed that. Third thing you've got to demonstrate, and this is where U.S. flunked the test, that there's a systematic exclusion, not only on that jury panel, but in prior jury panels.
Not just the facts, but a systematic intentional
exclusion. That's right.
Exclusion.
And it's got to be, you've got to go back, and in order to demonstrate that, you've got to go back and have the jury panel makeup of about the juries, all the prior juries prior to then for a number of years. And it's almost impossible to do that. I mean, that's one of those things. And then another thing they said, they point out the fact, and the way they tried to cure this in Texas when all these issues started coming up, they broadened the base of where they get jury panel members. At one time, we only used voter registration. And after everybody began to realize it underrepresented minorities, then they started extending it to driver's license, any type of tax you pay, anything on a tax roll. They pretty well expanded who all they call for jury service. And they pointed out in this case it was done by computer, and there was no showing of the people they selected. For example, those with driver's license that paid property taxes, there was no showing the racial makeup of that group. All they did was show the racial makeup of the county.
Mm-hmm.
So basically they said on appeal that they weren't able to demonstrate.
They didn't meet the burden.
That's right. And then the next thing that came up, and we've had, this is the only thing here recently that's been fairly successful, what we call a Batson issue. And that's where the state systematically excludes minority members off a jury panel. And let me kind of explain how that works. What happens when you're selecting a juror in a death penalty case, you call up each individual juror one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And each side has what we call 15 strikes. And the way it works, the jury will, in fact, the juror just takes the seat like a witness, and the judge kind of explains what's going on. The prosecutor questions that juror, and then the defense questions that juror. When both of them complete the questioning, they either accept or reject. Now, assuming that he's qualified, this particular individual is qualified, either the state's got to accept him and the defense got to accept him. And each person has 15 strikes. In other words, they've got 15 people they can eliminate for no reason. They just don't like
any reason.
Any reason. That's called a peremptory challenge. So what happened in a Batson case, what the argument is that the state uses peremptory challenges for racial reasons. And that's the argument that's been made over and over again. And we all know the famous case in Dallas where they even put in their DA's man, you should always strike members of minorities.
Yeah.
And everybody knows that pretty well happens. And here's where you've got to, and that was the second issue brought up. And here's how that works. It's really easy. There's another one of those three-part tests that we talk about. The first thing you've got to demonstrate as a defense lawyer is that the state used one or more of its peremptory challenges to strike a member of a minority. That's real easy to prove.
Yeah.
Because
if it happened, it happened.
Right. Because the way it works, you're all giving a list of the qualified jurors. And then you strike who's on the list, and you turn it in. You can look up the state structure there. They're doing open court, so you know who they struck. That part is real easy. Once you establish the state has used one or more of its strikes to strike a minority member, at that point the state has to advance what they call a race-neutral reason. In other words, they say, I struck juror A because, and I struck juror B because, I struck juror C because. And here there were four jurors that were struck. And the first race-neutral reason they gave on the first juror, they said that this one particular juror they struck had a health problem and told them when they were interviewing her that her health problem was such that she could not concentrate and give a fair hearing to the case. That's when they struck her, not because she happened to be a member of a minority,
because
she had a health problem. Then there was another one that said he was pretty much against the death penalty and kind of isolated back and forth of whether or not they could assess the death penalty. As you well know, you can have feelings against the death penalty, and you're qualified to serve so long as you don't automatically exclude it. If you say, well, I could probably give it, then you're qualified. This person vacillated back and forth, and that's the reason to say the state struck her. Then another one they struck because she was a state employee, and they didn't want somebody working for the state. And the fourth person they struck a lady because they said she was a psychologist. She had a master's degree in psychology, and too much education would scare the hell out of most district attorneys because they think if you're smart, you're going to not follow our BS, so they're going to strike her. Now, what you normally do, once the state advances those race-neutral reasons, here's where lawyers have been having some luck. They've been able to demonstrate some of those race-neutral reasons are pure shams because there have been white people who've had the same problems that they did not strike, and that's called disparity in treatment. For example, I struck Juror A because she had a health problem. She happened to be an African-American. Juror C, who's white, who's had the same health problem, was not struck. And so that's what they often look at is what they call disparity of treatment. In fact, all your recent cases reversed because of what we call bats and issues have been on disparity of treatment. Now,
maybe you should take a few minutes and tell us about what the deal was in Batson.
Batson just simply said that initially started out that a person has a right to, not to have minority members struck. They changed that, and what Batson basically says is that people who serve on juries have the right not to be struck based solely upon their race or gender. That's what it basically amounts to. It's pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward. In other words, you have the right to serve, and they can't knock you off because you happen to be a female, knock y'all because you happen to be a member of some minority
black
group.
Or Hispanic,
right,
or Hispanic. Asian.
Right.
Okay.
And it applies to civil cases. It applies to both sides. It applies to sex, not sexual preference, but to whatever sex of preference.
Gender.
You can't strike gender. And it applies to racial. It has to be a recognized racial reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Batson.
And Batson has been the law for how long?
That's been the law for about 20 years now.
Okay, so it's got some mileage on it. Some of the water's been under the bridge, and it has a pattern history.
Right.
Are there many Batson issues raised in recent cases?
That's been the only case that's got reversed recently. It was on a Batson issue. Because you had some, what they're going back is picking up a lot of those cases out of Dallas County where they were just really honest about their racial motivations and striking people. And they've got some of the, we've had one reversed by about 2 months ago, reversed on a Batson issue.
That happened in the Pondexter case.
And the Pondexter had a Batson issue, but they affirmed the case.
They affirmed the case.
Because they said the reasons advanced, there were four minority members struck. And they said the reason advanced by the state was race neutral. When the state explained why they struck them.
So Pondexter was not successful. He did raise the Batson issues, but it did not work in his case.
No.
Were there any other significant issues raised?
The major thing that they had a big flap about, and this is kind of one of those weird defenses, it's kind of a strange defense. The argument made was that when Pondexter shot the second shot, the woman was already dead. Therefore, he could not be guilty of murder. Because the first shot apparently went in her forehead and killed her. The second shot went into her temple, went through her mouth, down through her tongue. And the argument made was that when he fired the second shot, she was already dead. Therefore, he could not be as culpable for the capital murder because his shot did not kill her. Which is kind of a weak argument. And what's interesting, though, the Fifth Circuit, the district court, reversed it. They reversed the case after it had been affirmed on appeal based upon that issue. Here's what happened. And whether or not this is magic science or not, I don't know. The pathologist that did the autopsy claimed that Mrs. Lennox, was alive when both shots hit her. And here's what they say. They say when you're already dead and a bullet enters you, the markings around the bullet are yellow because there's no blood coming to the side of the wound because the blood's not circulating. But if you're alive when a bullet penetrates your body, you'll have some redness because blood goes to that area because your heart is still pumping.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's claiming because there was a redness around both bullet wounds, one in the forehead, one in the side of the head, that she was alive when the second shot was fired, which Pondexter admits firing the second shot.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole defense was, in fact, that's what the whole writ was built around, is that she was already dead when Poindexter fired the second shot, which is, you know, kind of a... They're really kind of cutting it, because most jurors aren't that subtle when you shoot somebody in the head twice in a row. The fact that the second one wasn't as bad as the first one is usually not a very good defense. But interesting enough, after the case was affirmed on appeal in the state courts, a federal district judge ruled that his lawyer was ineffective for not interviewing and putting on testimony from a pathologist that would have backed up a defensive theory that she was already dead when the second shot was fired. And on a federal writ, a federal district court judge said it made the lawyer ineffective, but the Fifth Circuit reversed that particular decision.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the issue on appeal.
Okay, I understand we've got a report from Gloria Ruback. Shabby, Gloria, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What's going on?
The AP reporter and some other reporters have come out. I haven't seen Willie's witnesses come out yet, but the execution has obviously happened. The state of Texas has murdered, the ninth person in seven weeks this year. And we have the Texas Department of Criminal Justice Mobile Command Center guarding all these murderers.
And describe that for us, Gloria.
Well, it's a truck that's sitting here. It's from the Office of Inspector General, Department of Criminal Justice, police, state police, God only knows, fascists, whoever.
Gloria, how many of these vigils outside of the death chamber have you participated in?
How many have I been to?
Uh-huh.
Oh, God. I don't know. Probably several hundred by now.
Well, at least several dozen.
Oh,
easily.
more than that.
Has there ever been any serious threat on anybody at these vigils?
I think it was George Cordova's execution. His sister was crying uncontrollably and walked on the grass and was met by 10 of these goons with big guns pointed at her while she was sobbing, and they told her they were going to shoot if she didn't stop.
And Atwood knowingly and intentionally crossed the line to get arrested and was.
Right.
But other than that, there's not, I mean, and none of that was a real threat to anybody, was it?
No, it was civil disobedience.
Civil disobedience and all well within the range that any activist would expect to happen.
Right.
And,
this big...
So the show of force is exactly some kind of street theater done by the establishment.
Exactly. They've got a big truck here, this mobile command center, like, you know, they're facing an onslaught. And I guess they got some extra money from somebody to have this, because this is relatively new.
An orgy of technical toys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gloria, tell us something about the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
The Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, which is the group I work with, is inviting people to come out to learn how to lobby the legislature. We're going to have a lobby session on the 14th of March at Shape Center in the cafe on Live Oak.
Mm-hmm.
And Harold Dutton's office and Jessica Farrar's office is going to provide funding. And then on the 24th of March, we're going to be going up to the Capitol to lobby. And we'll also be having a noon press conference and then a rally at 5 o'clock at the end of the day.
And I understand that Representative Jessica Farrar and Representative Lon Burnham from Dallas have introduced legislation to abolish the death penalty.
They have. They have a bill, and Harold Dutton also has a bill. And I read Jessica's today, and it's basically state law, but with everything... with a line through it that relates to the death penalty and executions.
Just strike those lines and it goes away.
Right, right. So that sounds good.
Do you actually plan on going to Austin and doing some lobbying?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and there's a number of bills to limit the use of the law of parties to not include executing anybody who didn't shoot anybody.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that law of parties can't be used. It just can't be used to execute people.
Right, it can't be used for capital to execute.
And now, Gloria, tell me, how do people get in touch with you there at the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement?
Our email is abolition.movement@hotmail.com, and my phone number is 713-503-2633.
Again, the number?
713-503-2633. And I encourage anybody who's opposed to the death penalty to come out and learn how to lobby, because we've got 24 bills. I'm sure that'll be whittled down, but a number of bills. So, you know, we're making progress in Texas, and we need people's help to push it a little bit forward every year.
Well, I mean, things are going on in Maryland right now, and things are going on in New Mexico right now, and so there is actually a movement that is getting some traction, not just in Texas, but across the country. Now, again, do you have local meetings, and when is the next one of those?
Well, our local meetings are the first Tuesday of the month. When there's an execution set for Tuesday, we meet the day before on the first Monday, which will be the case in March.
Okay.
Sorry, not March, April. It was the case
in March.
In March, and it's also the case for
in April. And the other question that I have is on the 14th of March?
Yeah.
That's when you do your lobby training day.
Training, yeah. It's from 2 to 4.
And where is the SHAPE Community Center building where that will occur?
The address is 3815 Live Oak.
3815 Live Oak, which is just off West Alabama to the east of Main Street.
What?
Or off Alabama to the east of Main Street.
Yeah, Alabama and Live Oak.
West Alabama does not go east of the Main Street. I have just been pointed out to me. It's east Alabama. It's not east Alabama. It's just Alabama.
Uh-huh.
Okay, Gloria, we're going to alert Nancy that the process is completed there. Give our regards to those at the vigil there, and good luck with your organizing.
Okay, thank you very much for doing Execution Watch.
Thank you, Gloria.
All right,
and
bye-bye.
That was Gloria Rubach from Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, and I'm sorry, Nancy Bailey is actually with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. These are apparently a parallel organization, and the website for Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty is www.tcadp.org, as in Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, tcadp.org is the website, and Elizabeth Stein is off to do that. While we've got this lull waiting to talk to Nancy, I'd like to remind you that Execution Watch comes to you every time Texas does an execution. We have another one scheduled for tomorrow night. We would not be able to do this if it were not for the technical skills of Otis McClay, who can be reached through this radio station and Pacifica National website. I could not do this without our producer, Elizabeth Stein. And, of course, I am always have the unique honor to be spending some time here in the studio with Jim Skelton, who is our legal analyst. And have you got her? Okay, let's get her on. Nancy, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Ray.
Hi, darling. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Where are you?
I'm on the corner of Shepherd and Westheimer.
Are you alone? Are other people there?
Well, they're breaking up, and they're on their way home now.
Oh.
I assume that the execution has probably happened.
Yeah, well, that's the point at which we call the second vigil to tell you that we have a report from Huntsville that the execution has been completed. The media has come out and crossed the road, and you know what that means.
That's too bad.
And this is the ninth execution this year, and we have one scheduled again for tomorrow.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty?
Yes. We had an excellent meeting last night, and our state president, who's on the Legislative Advocacy Committee, came and gave us a report on what's going on in the legislature and talked about the abolition bill. And we have a lobby day planned for March the 10th. It will begin, claiming will begin at 10 o'clock and last until 11:30. We'll be given literature, talking points and things to prepare us to talk to our, representatives and to, members of the, jurisprudence committee in the House.
Nancy, where is the training going to happen?
It's going to happen somewhere in the annex building of the Capitol itself.
Okay.
And there'll be further information coming on what the room number is. But what they're asking us to do is to register if we're coming. And you register by emailing lobbyday, one word, at tcadp.org or call 512-441-1808.
Again, the telephone number.
512-441-1808.
And the email address is lobbyday.
Lobbyday. At tcadp.org.
Okay.
And let them know that you're planning to come.
And this is...
Us are going to be carpooling up there, and we hope that maybe other carpool groups will form. And if you're registered, they will have a name tag for you that has your district number on it so that when you talk to your representative, they'll know who that you're actually in their district. So this will be a good thing.
Okay, and this is scheduled for March 10th. What day of the week 10th, is that?
That is a Tuesday. Tuesday of next week.
Okay.
They will then, like I say, when you register, they will tell you exactly which room to go to. And I understand we'll receive maps, which the Capitol's kind of difficult to get around in. And it should be a good day.
And if you're driving to Austin and you're not familiar with it, go downtown. Ever how you get to downtown on 290 or Highway 71?
Well, if you...
Anyway, you get downtown
coming
and...
Coming from 290, then you'll go south on the 35, and there'll be exits to show where the Capitol is. Or you can go by Interstate 10 and 71 and turn right on the 35, and it's somewhere the Capitol is closer to... the route of I-10 than it is to 290.
And if you're listening to Execution Watch in cities other than Houston, go downtown Austin. When you get downtown, get on Congress Avenue, and the northern end of Congress Avenue is the Capitol building.
Thank you, Ray.
Okay.
Great job of that.
Thank you, Nancy.
It's good to talk to you. I hope we won't always be having these conversations.
Well, give our regards to the vigilance tonight and those again tomorrow night on my behalf. I'm taking a sabbatical tomorrow. Y'all keep up the good work in my absence, and I'll be back with you in a week or so.
We will do our best to rise to the occasion.
Thank you, ma'am.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Nancy Bailey of the Texas... coalition to abolish the death penalty. All of our vigilants have been informed of the state of affairs, and Elizabeth's gone to go get that. But while she's doing that, Jim, all of this kind of heated up right at the last minute over some college students.
Yeah, one of those typical things is kiddos are trying to get information gathered to get a petition for clemency, and of course, as you well know, they were arrested and hassled by them.
That sounds like something out of Freedom Summer back in the 60s.
It's hard to imagine this going on today. I mean, it's just kind of shocking.
Old Bull Connor would be be alive and well and proud that this kind of activity. What happened is we had a couple of Harvard law students out doing some research to prepare for the clemency application.
Right, exactly.
And there are deadlines as in that, so that the governor knows to get up that day and consider clemency in this situation. And en route to those deadlines, the Harvard law students who were coming down here to assist as, I guess, interns in capital punishment work in Texas, because they don't currently have capital punishment in Massachusetts, I don't suppose. So they're down here to learn something about the laws in the Netherlands. And they got pulled over. They were trying to interview employees of Texas prison system on the issue of continued dangerousness.
Here's the deal, and this is one of these kind of sad cases, Ray, because truthfully, if this is one of those instances where somebody's being held responsible for the conduct they did, they were a 19-year-old kid.
Mm-hmm.
And from all reports, this guy has adjusted extremely well on death row.
Well, let's get Gabriel Salas in here, and then you and I can continue that, because we're going to have some time left over. Gabriel.
Yes.
Gabriel Salas, you are the associate director of the Texas After Violence Project. What is that?
Well, first, thank you for having me, Ray. Texas After Violence Project, we're an independent organization in Austin,
mm-hmm.
And we seek to kind of understand the widespread effects of the death penalty on individuals and communities in Texas. Our goals, of course, are to engage the public to think critically about the effects throughout the entire process. Of the death penalty, from the crime itself through the entire litigation process and on into the execution. Frankly, the public doesn't know about the distribution of trauma that goes on at all stages during the death penalty. And what we do is we just try to listen to people's stories who have been affected by the death penalty through oral history interviews. And the reason we do that is it allows people to emphasize whatever stories or memories or facts in their own experience that they feel are essential to the public record and that they feel that the public needs to understand to get a better understanding of what the death penalty does to people and communities in Texas.
And what are you finding?
Well, we're finding a lot, right? I mean, frankly, there's a lot of themes that recur in our interviews and it's typically the case that people who want to share their stories felt like they've dealt some kind of injustice throughout the process, and that's not every interview that we take. There's a lot of stories of problems with inadequate legal representation. There's a lot of problems surrounding the issue of the execution of mentally ill people, just in my own personal experience doing this work. But it's just there's fundamental problems throughout the entire process. And that's just something that I don't think that the official record really... As a matter of fact, I know the official record doesn't reflect that.
Well, no, the official record is a rather sterile set of recordings. And it has impressed me from observing this phenomena for a good number of years that there is a ritualistic quality to the practice of execution that seems to be a way to distract attention from the level of violence that this actually accomplishes. Now, that's a lay opinion based on my observation, and I liken it unto the ritual process of human sacrifices in pre-Columbian societies, where in this continent, where they would take the selected virgin or captive from the battlefield and drag them up a set of stairs and cut out their heart and go through this ritual thing. And executions in Texas are very similar in nature.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and we think that it's important that we supplement the official record with what's actually happening to these people, who are touched by the death penalty, and but you're exactly right. It's become so ritualistic that it's almost disgusting to think how most people in Texas have become so accustomed to the death penalty that they don't seem to ask questions or seem to want to pay attention to the actual effects of what's going on with everybody involved. It seems like you get a brief, crude summary of the crime itself, and then nothing else. But there's so much more. There's so much more that goes on throughout that entire process.
But let's inventory the people that are affected by execution directly. Certainly there are the survivors of the victims.
I would even take it further than that, Ray. I would say that at the beginning, you know, there's the crime itself, and everybody who's involved in the crime scene, all the way up into the investigations, and then you have, of course, you're right, you have the victims, you have their families, you have the offenders and their families, attorneys, jurors, detectives, everybody at some level throughout the process is affected by the death penalty. And I think that you can go on and on and on about how they're affected and in what ways, but this is something that's not available in the public record right now, and I think that's troubling. You know, you'll never know whether something is factual or false or incomplete unless you know about the individual experiences themselves. And that's something that I think motivates the work of our project.
Well, and how you record these things? Or do you have audio recordings?
We do. To date, we've done about 50 oral history interviews, and we've done about 47 of those on video, which I think is remarkable that these people not only welcome us into their homes to give us their stories, but that they're willing to give their testimonies on videos. Because just as much as we're trying to figure out and gain some kind of understanding of the widespread effects of the death penalty, we're also trying to supplement the historical record as well. So in response to your question, we typically videotape the interviews, but if for some reason they don't want to be on tape, we'll do an audio recording.
Well, you know, I am reminded of the anguishing process that Sister Helen Prejean took all of her readers and viewers of the movie version of her work through as she dealt with the survivors of the victims, the murder scene itself, and certainly the perpetrators, and the process of going through their execution. It was all one continuum of violence.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
And she was trying to put it in terms of her spiritual evolution. And I think that the whole plot, if you see the movie, you see that she's trying to bridge that gap. But the fact of the matter is that the anguishing voices is enormous. What do you hope your material will become?
Well, I think that there's a lot of potential to how this information can be used. I think first and foremost, though, we've got to make it accessible to the public. People have to be able to answer their own questions that they have about violent crime, especially the death penalty in Texas. They need to be able to answer their own questions based off of the experiences of individuals themselves. And so, again, I think that you can use the information in a lot of ways, but I think first and foremost, it's got to be accessible. People have to have access to this information so they can inform their own beliefs about this practice. And I just want to say something about Mr. Pondexter's case. Recently, there was an article in The Observer about how TDCJ wouldn't allow some of the corrections officers to speak on behalf of Mr. Pondexter's...
Well, they used local sheriffs. It was a Bull Connor kind of thing. It reminded me of Freedom Summer.
But these are the people, I think, that need to be listened to the most closely, I think. And, you know, and it doesn't have to be in a legal setting like it was with Mr. Pondexter, but these are the people who knew him most, right?
Yes, in recent years, yeah.
Who knew him while he lived on death row, and yet they were not able to share their experiences with anybody. So that's a little different than what we do, but I think that just goes to show how the official...
Well, if they won't let those Harvard students do it in pursuit of somebody's individual cases, wouldn't it be a natural thing for your organization or group to reach out and do it in a more neutral context?
Yes, yes. I mean, and in fact, we, we want to listen to anybody's stories. I think that's important to emphasize. That it would be there, you know, when you're looking at the widespread effects of the death penalty, it's really hard to break it up into sides. You know?
Can the listeners to Execution Watch access some of the actual materials that you've accumulated?
Yes, eventually they will. Right now, because, as you could probably understand, we have a thorough consent process just because of this very sensitive material. People are essentially revisiting the most traumatic experiences of their lives on tape, and so we have a very thorough consent process where we make sure that their interests are primary, right? So we make sure that they're in complete control of how their interviews are being used and all that. So right now we don't have any videos that are online or public, but we're working on that, and we're also looking at publishing the transcripts of those.
If someone went to your website, what would they find?
If you went to our website right now, you'd get a great sense of the work that we do, probably a lot better than I just summarized here for you. And they'll also get an idea of where we've been and what kinds of interviews we've done and why we do oral history interviews, why we think that's important. But again, we're a fairly new project. We're proud of the work that we've done so far. We've got a lot of work to do still, and our website, I think, will develop in the very near future.
Okay, the website, incidentally, for the listeners, is www.texasafterviolence.org.
Yes, sir. And I would encourage anybody who might be interested in sharing their story, their experiences with the death penalty with us and eventually with the public, contact us. And we've traveled around Texas together, and we do these interviews, and we meet some pretty amazing people along the way.
Okay, actually, I've just been informed by our webmaster that we're linking to you now. You go to our website, check lines, and you will be linked to the website at TexasAfterViolence.org.
Yes, and again, people should also feel free to give us a call here at our office and talk to us in more detail about the project and our interview process and how their stories can be used and all that stuff.
And Gabriel, you might go to our website and check to see if we do it right. We are at executionwatch.org.
Okay, thank you.
And listen, I appreciate you joining. I wish you good work. I think that you're on to something there. I don't know if you're familiar with our other work with the prison show here on KPFT.
Yes.
It's also available online. And at some future date, I'm thinking about having you in as a guest so you can solicit some of those people who actually work or have worked in the prison system to come in and talk about their experiences with death row inmates.
Thank you. And those are some of the people whose experiences matter the most.
Yes, and I've had some conversations with those people, usually in guarded circumstances. They're just working blokes.
Yeah.
Trying to make a living, support their families and dependents by working for a stingy state.
Yeah.
How are you funded, by the way?
Right now we are funded by a family that wishes to remain anonymous, but
okay.
We are in the process of finding more funding, and I think that our work is compelling. I think it's interesting, and I think it's important.
Well, it's certainly enthralling to somebody who's been in the vineyard for a while. Thank you very much, Gabriel.
For having
Gabriel
me.
Solis of Texas After Violence organization, and its website is TexasAfterViolence.org. Thank you for joining us on Execution Watch.
Thanks, Ray.
Bye-bye. And that was Gabriel. Gabriel is some interesting fellow. I'm back with Jim. Jim, we were beginning to converse about that Bull Connor stuff.
Right. What struck me, Ray, and when I was reading all the cases on this, I was reminded of what Truman Capote had written in Cold Blood. If you recall, that was a book based upon two men who killed a family in Kansas. And what was real interesting, they had both of them examined by psychiatrists. And here's what the psychiatrist said, and it reminded me of the Pondexter case. The psychiatrist said, and there were two guys involved, a guy named Hickok and a guy named Smith.
Sure.
And he
said that writing that book, incidentally, destroyed Truman Capote.
And what the psychiatrist basically said is that neither person alone would have done the killing. But the combination of the two personalities created a third psychological being that did the killing. And in this particular case, I had that very same impression. You had four people that apparently had been members of gangs. They were talking about being Crips and doing all that gangster talk. And they're young, fairly young kids, 19 years old, kind of hyping each other up. And talking about being man enough to take somebody's life, being a man enough to take out somebody, that sort of stuff they were talking about. And it's that gang mentality. And when you get your adrenaline flowing that bad when you're a 19-year-old kid, and truthfully, it's that kind of the gang is the one that did the killing. I don't think Pondexter by himself would have done it. Anybody individually probably would not have done it. But it's much like the dealing of the Capote book, that the kind of the combination of that particular night, the setting of that night, and what they basically did, they executed somebody that doesn't exist anymore, because he was a 19-year-old kid running around with a bunch more little gangster kids, and the person they killed tonight was not the very same person that actually did the execution.
I suspect they rarely kill the person that did the crime. That may happen.
We've had a few, Ray, that, you know, that
they pretty are spooky, huh?
That didn't change a whole lot.
Recently. Yeah.
Recently.
Right.
We've had some. Pondexter, again, was the exception in this sense. He was not an ex-convict. He had not been at the penitentiary before. He was raised in primarily around the Oklahoma area. Now, he was had some problems as a juvenile. And always had kind of a problem with violence, robbing people, and carrying guns. Now, that was a part of his lifestyle. But far as being a real violent person prior to this time, no. Part of being the penitentiary prior to this time, no. He'd been adjudicated as a delinquent, but had been on probation the entire length of time. And like I say, what's interesting, when he got put in a real controlled environment like the prison on death row, he apparently had absolutely no problems. And this is the sad part, because the very people who could have gone to the Board of Pardons and Paroles who would have some weight, namely the people that work with him every day, were the very ones, these kiddos, were prevented from interviewing to present a petition for clemency to the parole board. And those would be the ones that, to me, would have the most credibility and believability of people to see Pondexter every day, saw how he reacts. And what they knew they really killed was somebody who didn't exist. The person that did, the 19-year-old kid that did the killing, they did not kill tonight. It was somebody else.
This is not easy work.
No.
I do not come to this radio station with a lot of excitement about doing these programs, and I know Jim anguishes over tracking down the legal history, which is also not easy work. If you're listening to this show and you have some knowledge of how to work your way around a law book or the websites or the of appellate courts and find opinion, we need somebody to belly up to the bar here and offer to relieve Jim periodically, because sometimes he too has got to go to the bathroom. I'm going to the bathroom for a couple of programs tomorrow night and the first one next week. And we have found substitutes for everybody else, but finding a substitute for Jim is not easy, because of the sacrifice in time it takes to track all of this down. Execution Watch is not a joy in our life. Execution Watch is an obligation that we think as citizens of the world and this nation and this state have an obligation to expose to you those few interested people who are concerned about it. And we come together because we were concerned that the rest of the media were missing something by not giving you the details, oh, how gruesome they may be, of these cases. We talk about the crime itself, and frequently that's not a pretty story to tell. And then we start talking about the legal
mechanics of the defense process, and that frequently is not a pretty story to tell. And then we try to bring in someone each week to talk about the search for some level of truth in the field of the extreme business of the state taking lives in a kind of ritualistic revenge. We can't change the politics. And we suspect that even if people that disagreed with us a lot were listening, that we would do very much at changing their opinion. I've been doing broadcasts around the criminal justice system now for almost 29 years, ever since I was general manager of radio station KPFT and could do anything I wanted to with radio. And I thought I would ultimately run out of material in maybe a couple of 3 years, but it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and makes less and less sense all the time. If we were making the world safer by killing people, I would say, all right, we are accomplishing something. If we were making the world safer by locking people up, I would say, all right, then there's some justice. But what actually happens is that people get worse. Violent people get more violent, but the more crime and criminals they're around. You send people to prison, and it's like going to college, where they learn to do more and more violent and more dangerous things, and they leave a trail of victims. 70% of the people who go to Texas prison the first time will be back the second time. 80% of the people who go the second time will be back the third, and most of those will spend their adult lives in prison, or at least until they get as old as Dan Grunstrom, and it's not fun anymore.
And another thing, Ray, a lot of those people end up on death row have been those who've graduated from the college
from the best colleges in the world to teach violence and to teach. Seems like society says we don't value your life. Those people begin to put less value on other people's lives. Not everybody. This is, Poindexter is an exception to that. Poindexter was a young man who did it, got high and strung out and drunk and did crazy, stupid, horrible things. And for that, he died tonight. But how many Poindexters could be diverted? I am sure. As he started misbehaving, his mother nagged him not to do that. But nagging doesn't work. I am sure along the trail he found juvenile counselors and probation officers that said, if you don't turn it around, it's going to get worse. And it did. Somehow or other, we say we're going to punish somebody or execute somebody because we're sending a message. But I hate to tell you that those to whom you are trying to send a message never seem to be answering the phone and receiving it. No, we do not enjoy this work, but we would invite you to come join us and help us in this work because we think this work is important. We could not do this show if it were not for the technical genius of Otis McClay, who will probably be hosting tomorrow night's show. We could not do this work if it were not for the organizing genius of Elizabeth Stein, who will probably take tomorrow off, too. In substitute for Elizabeth, we're going to have Marlo Thomas in here to
Marlo Blue
in here to organize the system for you. And so then Otis will substitute for me. The theme music that we begin this program with and in this program with is Victoria Panetti. And you can reach Victoria's music by www.myspace.com/shemonster. An easy MySpace to remember. This is Ray Hill. Thanks for listening to Execution Watch on executionwatch.org. Thank you.
fresh out of the service. It was back in 82. I raised some cane when I come back to town.